Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our friend and guest, Dr. Mimi Guarneri. Dr. Guarneri is board certified in cardiovascular disease, internal medicine, nuclear cardiology, and integrative holistic medicine. She's president of the Academy of Integrative Health and Medicine, serves on the founding board of the American Board of Physician Specialties in Integrative Medicine, and is a clinical associate professor at University of California, San Diego. Dr. Guarneri is co-founder and medical director of Guarneri Integrative Health Incorporated at Pacific Pearl in La Jolla, California, where she leads a team of experts in conventional, integrative, and natural medicine. She's author of The Heart Speaks, A Cardiologist Reveals the Secret Language of Healing, and her newest book, 108 Pearls to Awaken Your Healing Potential. So now, Mimi, we are so appreciative of your groundbreaking work and so excited for this time with you. And now for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Mimi. Thank you very, very much for being with us again.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm so struck by your story, your journey. You lost your mom when you were just 8 years old and your dad when you were 17, and both of those tragedies were related to heart disease. Then, years later, here you become a cardiologist. Sometimes the suffering that we experience and the loss we experience in our lives, we shut down, we close down from it. But other times, maybe we shut down for a while, but then we make use of it in some way. It transforms us. It gives us our life in some real meaningful way. What happened for you in this?
Well, that's a great question to lead off with. And as you can imagine, it's a pretty deep philosophical one. Truthfully, I believe, and this is my belief system now, that the soul comes in to learn some very important lessons. And in many ways, we pick our parents to be the ones that allow our soul to do the work that it's come here to do. And I really, truly believe that. Because when I look back on my life, and I look back at the challenges, very big deal for a girl in particular, but any child at 8 years old to lose a mom suddenly, and a dad at 17, I was also blessed at the same time with a very large extended Italian family that was able to step in, able to nurture and be there and, care for myself and my brothers. So I when I go back and I look at it, I think this, you know, our challenges shape who we are. And certainly I could have taken a different path and said, poor me, look at all these traumas that I had and, pass the bacon and eggs kind of thing, or we can become stronger. And I was fortunate enough to be one of those who was able to say, it really propelled me to go on my mission, which I knew from a very early age that I would be a physician. And this just reinforced it for me. So sometimes those things that happen to us, as you know, can really make us stronger. And there's this human spirit that has the will to live. For each of us, it's kindled by different things.
It is. And I know that at one time you were basically doing a lot of stents and you were researching stents and you were researching intracoronary radiation. And somehow you went from that to working with the Dean Ornish program and where social support plays a key role. How did that happen?
It's a funny story, and you obviously have done your homework. So, I was really very much into the adrenaline pumping side of interventional cardiology. And I was doing over 700 surgeries a year at one point. And I remember very clearly, I opened the door to the cardiac catheterization lab. I just finished a procedure, and there was a man standing behind the door who I didn't know at the time, but ended up being Dean Ornish. And he said, oh, I'm looking for you. I've been told, you know, you're the one who can conduct some research. And, of course, my initial reaction was, oh, this guy has a new stent or he has a new catheter of some type, you know, some interventional tool, that the toys, as I would put it. And he turned to me and he said, well, I want you to take these really sick heart patients that you can't fix with a stent, and I want you to teach them yoga and meditation and vegetarian diet and put them in support groups and exercise, you know, all the great things we know now about the Ornish program. And I really looked at him like he was crazy. I said, you have the wrong person. And to his credit, he said, no, I talked to Dr. Paul Tierstein, who at that time was my mentor, and he said, you can do this. You're the one who can pull this off. And I thought, all right, here's a huge challenge. And it was a huge challenge because I have to tell you, I was trained in no lifestyle medicine at all. I mean, if you can imagine going through 4 years of 3 years of internal medicine training, 3 years of cardiology training, and one extra year of interventional cardiology training, that's 7 years, and no lifestyle medicine ever taught. It's unbelievable when you think about it. And so I started to put the program together and started bringing in these really sick heart patients who, quite frankly, right in front of my eyes, over the course of a year, went from out of shape, couldn't walk, couldn't breathe, diabetic, chest pain, to what I like to call affectionately at the end of the day, lean, mean fighting machines. You know, and I just, and to watch this transformation just opened up my eyes. And I said, oh my God. And it became very clear to me that we have a science of disease. This stent is good for this blood vessel, and this drug is good for this stent, and so on. And we apply that in healthcare, but we also have a science of health that we're not applying at all. And the reason we don't apply the science of health to our patients is you have, you know, thousands and thousands of physicians that haven't been trained in this area.
And you weren't either in your long years of medical training. There was really no lifestyle component, I'm hearing. In 1990, 27 years ago, the official guidelines put forth then by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association for treating people who had heart attacks was 38 pages long. And in all of those 38 pages, lifestyle measures were mentioned once in a single brief paragraph. Now, fast forward to last year in 2016, the annual conference of the American College of Cardiology featured for the first time an intensive focus on lifestyle medicine. The presenters and panelists were American College of Cardiology President Dr. Kim Williams, who spoke on the heart benefits of a vegan diet, Dr. Dean Ornish, who we were just mentioning, who spoke on the topics of love and loneliness and connection, and Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn, who presented on nutrition and heart disease. Mimi, clearly something is changing. How do you view this change? What do you think we can expect to see in the coming years? And how do you feel about all this?
Well, first of all, yay, and it's about time. Because when you think about it, John, it's absolutely ridiculous. All the things that cause cardiovascular disease, whether it's from diabetes to high blood pressure to toxins in the environment to stress and anxiety and depression and all of these things are lifestyle issues. And yet we have continued for the last how many years to start to treat these things with just a drug, ill to the pill. You have high blood pressure, take this pill. You have high cholesterol, take that pill. And a lot of that has been the training of physicians. That's how they're trained. You name it, you blame it, and you tame it with a drug or a surgery. And that's the teaching model. Now, for the first time, we've reached a point where we have a country that is morbidly obese, that it, we rank number one in obesity in the world, number one in diabetes. We have all of the sequela. If you just look at the sequela of obesity alone, from heart disease to blood pressure to sleep apnea to erectile dysfunction to dementia. I mean, the list goes on. Fatty liver disease. We have all of these things that are lifestyle-related diseases. And we have people like Esselstyn, like Ornish, who have been shouting in the wilderness for years. Even though this is all out there, at the end of the day, we still need to get these cardiologists trained and all the doctors trained, which is why I'm president of the Academy of Integrative Health and Medicine. We had over 1,000 participants at our conference here in October, all healthcare providers, mainly physicians, saying, I want to do things differently. So we have to get people trained, and we have to find a way to pay for it. We need the training of a new breed of healthcare providers, which we're working very hard to do, and we also need money that is put into prevention, lifestyle medicine, put into the creation of health as opposed to just treating disease. So there are a lot of steps that have to occur. And that's why I'm so glad you have the audience that you have, because I believe that people can take control of their own health and the health of their heart and their brain and everything else is in their hands. And it starts in their kitchen. And that's powerful medicine.
When you say it starts in their kitchen, you're referring to, of course, to what we eat, what we put in our mouths, and how we fuel our bodies. And you've said that if you had to pick the world's perfect diet, it would be a vegetarian or vegan diet. Now, there are some vegetarians and vegans who eat very healthfully and get a lot of phytonutrients and phytochemicals and lots of fresh vegetables and so forth. But there are plenty of vegetarians and vegans who eat a lot of bagels and macaroni and cheese and pizza. And basically, their diet is not much of an improvement, if at all, over the standard American diet. How, if you were going to design an optimum diet in terms of heart health, what would it be?
Well, traditional Mediterranean diet is going to give you lots of green leafy vegetables, escarole and broccoli and cabbage and, you know, all your cruciferous vegetables and lentils and beans and legumes, all of these wonderful things. Now you can say, gee, Mediterranean diet, that sounds Italian to me. Well, I'm going to have exactly what you just described, pasta and cheese, pizza and cheese, and so on. I really like to say a high phytonutrient diet, which is the, you know, the colors of the rainbow, filled with lots of nuts, seeds, beans, legumes, green vegetables, cruciferous vegetables, low glycemic vegetables in general, and healthy forms of fat. So you have your small amounts of your olive oil, your olives, again, your nuts, and so on. So I really try to encourage my patients to get healthy vegetarian protein sources into their diet. And one of the challenges with this is that people have not been trained to cook a vegetarian diet, which is why over at my place, Pacific Pearl, you know, we have a cooking school because people have to learn how to sprout beans. They have to learn how to cook maybe with a crock pot or with a wok and small volumes of food. We eat way too much in this country, too much volume and too much volume of the wrong things, simple sugar, simple carbohydrates. You know, so I tell my patients, if you want a carb, let's go for some quinoa. Sure, let's try some quinoa. Let's try to do some baking with some buckwheat. Let's learn how to mix and match different types of healthier, low glycemic grains and carbs if you need them. Frequently, I have to add a protein smoothie, you know, or a green smoothie with some extra protein in it to make sure they're getting the protein that they need. But you can absolutely 100% be a healthy, healthy vegetarian or a healthy, healthy vegan. You absolutely can.
Well, I hear you saying to lean into the non-starchy vegetables, lean into the low glycemic veggies and grains and whole grains and lean, if you want to be lean and healthy and vibrant. And I asked you, you know, what might be an optimum diet in terms of heart health, but really the same diet, I think, and I believe you would agree with me, but I want to check this out. The same diet that would be optimum in terms of heart health would also be very, very similar, if not identical, to the optimum diet in terms of cancer prevention, in terms of dementia or Alzheimer's prevention, in terms of preventing all of the lifestyle diseases that plague us today.
100% right. And you know what's so interesting to me? So when you think of the vascular system, right? Blood vessels. They go from the top of your head to the tips of your toes. So what's good for the heart is good for the kidney, is good for the brain, and so on. And it's fascinating to me to watch what's happening in neurology now because, you know, with the heart, we started with, you know, we said heart attack. Let's mobilize the cath lab. Let's do the stents. Let's do all of that. And then about 20 years later, the neurologist who said, oh, we can't do anything for stroke, now is saying, they call it now brain attack when someone comes into the emergency room and they start advanced intervention, get the clot out of the brain and so on, like we have been doing in the heart forever. Now what's happening, if you read Dale Bredesen's work, which I think is great, you see that the same, he's applying the same principles we apply to the heart, to the brain, and he's showing that you can reverse dementia. And this is very powerful. So what he's looking at, the same exact things that we've been looking at for years, homocysteine levels, fasting insulin levels, diabetes, hemoglobin A1C, heavy metals, copper-zinc ratios, and so on. And so he has a list of over 30 checkpoints that he does to get people to reverse their dementia. It's the same list we use for the heart. So you're right on with this.
Mimi, you mentioned Dale Bredesen's work, Reversing Dementia. I've just actually been looking at that recently, and I want to tell our listeners a little bit about it. It's so groundbreaking. Dale Bredesen, as you know, Mimi, heads the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Research at UCLA. And in 2014, he published a truly landmark study in the journal Aging. Now, what made his study so stunning is that he took people with Alzheimer's disease, put them on his program, and 9 out of 10 of them showed dramatically improved cognitive functioning within 6 months. What makes this amazing is there's no drug that can even slow the disease progression, and here he is showing that his program can actually reverse Alzheimer's disease. Our listeners may be wondering at this point what his program entails. In his program, Dale Bredesen asks people with Alzheimer's to eliminate all simple carbohydrates, gluten, and processed food, eat more vegetables and fruits and wild fish, do some basic meditation and yoga, sleep 7 to 8 hours a night, take certain supplements, namely melatonin, vitamin B12, vitamin D3, fish oil, and coenzyme Q10, pay attention to their oral hygiene and use an electric flosser and electric toothbrush. Go 12 hours between dinner and breakfast, and go 3 hours between dinner and bedtime, and exercise for a minimum of 30 minutes, 4 to 6 days per week. Now, that's essentially the Bredesen program, and it has been shown to reverse cognitive decline in people with Alzheimer's disease in 90% of the participants in his program. Mimi, more and more people now are seeing that the brain is actually part of the body. The heart is not a silo, that we are integrated systems, and that what we eat affects every organ and every cell in our bodies. And now we're seeing that cognitive impairment and dementia can effectively be treated with lifestyle intervention and lifestyle treatments. This was unheard of until recently. Drug companies have been spending billions of dollars looking for a drug that could just arrest Alzheimer's symptoms, and now we're beginning to find that lifestyle programs can reverse these symptoms. To me, this is real healing. And as you mentioned, Mimi, Bredesen's program is very similar to the Ornish program, which has been proven to reverse heart disease.
Right. And when Ornish did his work on prostate cancer, Gleason 6 prostate cancer, and using a vegan diet and lifestyle change, down-regulating 500 cancer genes. And part of it is we now have the language of science to understand this. You know, years ago, before we had genetic arrays, before we had fMRI, we didn't really even have this technology to understand, for example, what's going on in the brain with meditation? What's going on in the brain when we put acupuncture needles into someone? And what's going on a genetic level when someone learns to meditate or when someone does a lifestyle change program like Jean studied with, you know, the prostate cancer men? So we're now starting to have that language of science that we can apply to this so that people, you know, people who still need in their left brain to see things like these kinds of genetic arrays changing and so on, they still need to see that type of stuff to believe what I think, quite frankly, is just common sense. You know, I really don't think we need to spend $5 million studying organic blueberries. I think it's insane. That's just my personal thought.
Well, unless that's what it takes to convince.
Right. Right. And that's my point.
Yes.
That's what it takes to convince them.
Yes.
To convince the medical audience that we have to change, but we have the science. We do, honestly, every day the science is growing and growing and growing, but that science needs to be part of medical school education. We need to train our young docs differently, and we need to value. I know when I went to cardiology training all those years, you know, there was something called cardiac rehab. Oh, that's a place where people went after they had their heart attack. And it really is, it was considered soft medicine. Oh, if you were the rehab doctor, you were like the soft medicine doctor. No one paid any attention to you. You had the room in the corner. You know, we need to change what we value in this country. We still value the surgeon more than we value the lifestyle change doctor. And that's a big issue.
It is. And that valuing shows up in reimbursement. And that then creates perverse incentives. I'm thinking about your journey because you were trained, as so many physicians today still are. And there was not lifestyle medicine in your training. You spent years as an intervention cardiologist. You spent most of your days propping open arteries with metal sleeves. But at some point, Mimi, it obviously occurred to you to ask why these people's arteries were blocked in the first place. How did that question arise, and what was the process you went through to make the radical changes that you made?
Well, you know, for me, it was part of it was starting to do the Ornish research. But the other part of it was, I call it the revolving door. I would come in the morning, and really, I was, for practical purposes, when you put stents in and do intervention, it's like you're a, you know, you're a hired gun to do a procedure, literally. And I'd walk in the morning, and I'd see the list of people, and the names would start to repeat themselves over and over and over again. So that's the first aha. Why is Mr. So-and-so coming back with, you know, new blockage? Oh, why is someone who's just had a bypass back with blockage in their new bypass grafts 5 years later? What, you know, what's the disconnect here? And then I would look at those patients that I was treating in the cardiac cath lab during the day. And you know how we go around and make rounds at night? And I would make rounds, and I kid you not, they would be eating roast beef and mayo sandwiches on white bread. They would have Ensure on their tray. Diabetics would have mashed potatoes and, you know, beef stroganoff, all this stuff. And I thought, oh my God, there's such a disconnect between we just did this high level intervention. And now this person goes up to the recovery room or the ICU or wherever they are, and they're getting a roast beef and mayo sandwich on white bread and Ensure. And what does that tell the patient? That says to the patient, oh, this must be okay. I got it in the hospital. And then you have nutritionists who, I'm sorry to say, at least, you know, when I was spending a lot of time in the hospital, that were teaching people things like, and I kid you not, switch your bacon from regular bacon to Canadian bacon. You know, use lard sparingly. And I remember looking at these handouts and I was going, oh my God. And so this aha moment occurred of, you know, the disconnect between how aggressive we were on the intervention side and how poor we were on the prevention side. And I remember going to the chief of cardiology at the time, and I said, listen, we need to create a lifestyle change prevention program that's as aggressive as our intervention program, because they have to be equally as strong. And that was an aha moment for me, walking around and seeing this. And it was even scarier when I started to speak to this and lecture on it. I would go and make my ICU rounds. The nurses then would see me coming, and they would hide the plates of food. They would cover the food with napkins. They say, oh, Dr. Guarneri's coming, hide the food. And they would think it was funny. But then I would go into the nursing station, and there would be cinnamon buns and boxes of chocolate and Coca-Cola. And I realized, you know, and that took me to a whole other realization. Oh, my God, we have to train our practitioners about health. They're not healthy themselves. And so, you know, sort of the, they say that when you're ready, the teacher appears, and the teacher started to appear in all these different forms, from Dr. Ornish to reading. I became an avid reader in this area, and just observing everything around me. It's like all of a sudden my eyes opened, and I thought, I can't not do something about this. And that was the big piece of the journey for me.
Well, I'm so glad that you couldn't not do something about it. And I know you undertook the Ornish program. You participated in it not merely as a cardiologist, but as a right along with your patients. And you had been eating pepperoni pizza, you wrote, and you became a vegetarian. You began doing yoga and you began meditating. You learned new ways to manage and lessen stress. Your cholesterol numbers without medication dropped considerably, I understand. And then it had this immense effect on your cardiology practice. So this really was meeting Dean Ornish, starting to study his work, going through the program. What it was a life-transforming event for you.
It was, and it also made me aware that if I'll just use physician as an example. If a physician is going to buy in and understand this, they have to do it and practice it themselves. When I was asked to do the research, and I knew nothing about this, I said to myself, I have to learn meditation. I have to learn, yoga. I have to learn to be a vegetarian. How am I going to teach my patients a vegetarian diet if I'm not a vegetarian? How can I teach my patients to meditate if I don't meditate? So that became the transformation for me, watching my patients and then watching myself. My cholesterol went from 320, which is shocking, to 100. I had a total cholesterol of 100. And then I thought, okay, I could eat a little bit more fat. And because I did a really more than a strict 10% fat diet, which was the research at the time, vegetarian diet. And I said, oh, well, I'm going to add back in some olive oil and some nuts. And, you know, I don't have heart disease and I'm not trying to reverse heart disease, but I never added in beef, pork, and lamb, and chicken, and turkey ever, ever, ever. So, you know, I had to learn this, and in the learning process, that's when I became a teacher for my patients. And I think that's a critical piece to transformations. And that's what happened to me. I went through this experience myself.
I'm thinking how often we are affected by the people around us in deep ways. And I'm remembering what you said earlier about how you got through the tragedies of your earlier life, partly through the support of your social network and extended family. And I know in the Ornish program, one of the key things is it's not just a one-on-one meeting with a doctor. It's a social support group. And that issue, you know, sometimes we're conditioned to think something scientifically valid only when we can measure it in a test tube or in a lab. And something as fuzzy or ephemeral as human relationships can seem touchy-feely, hardly the stuff of sound science. But there really is a great deal of sophisticated research that's confirmed the healing powers of friendship and love and positive relationships.
You know what? That is the secret glue. That's the secret sauce. So imagine this. If you're a person who's just had a heart attack or a stent, you know, you're puttering along in your life one day, you get chest pain, you get whisked off to the hospital, and now you're told you have coronary disease, you have this quick procedure, stent, whatever it is, and you go home and you're on 5 new medications. And it's get you in and get you out, and no one is really, you know, they give you some handouts, and they say, okay, eat this way, do this. You go home, and you are in shock. 9 out of 10 people are in shock. What just happened to me? And now you take those individuals, and you leave them home alone, which, you know, we always say the I in illness is isolation. You leave them home alone to try to figure it out on their own. They see the physician every 3 or 4 months if they're lucky, and they're not getting any instruction in lifestyle medicine. Or you can take those same people and do what we did when we did the research, and you bring them in and you put them in a group. We call them cohorts, which are, you know, means band of warriors. And we put them in a group of 20 or so together, and instantly you have 20 new friends, and you're able to tell your story. And as one patient said to me, he said, I thought I was in bad shape until I heard Joe's story, you know. And all of a sudden now there's this bond, there's this camaraderie, there's this support that goes on that is absolute magic. And it was the one thing we really couldn't. We didn't have a number to measure at the time we did the research, but we knew that those groups that bonded, that had that social support, came in 3 times a week, exercised together, cooked together, did yoga and meditation together. It became family. Everyone knew everyone. It was absolutely beautiful. And if someone had a health challenge, let's say someone had recurrent chest pain or a problem, and they had to go to the cardiac cath lab, guess what? They had 10 people going with them. They weren't going alone. They had people visiting them in the room, sitting with them. The whole experience became different. It was totally healing. And so, again, this part of the whole Ornish program was eye-opening for me as a physician. I thought, why aren't we teaching people in groups? Why aren't we empowering people to teach each other? Quite frankly, I wouldn't wait around for a hospital to figure it out, because a hospital's business is sick care. Let's face it, if you have a heart attack, a stroke, you need a pacemaker, you need to be in a hospital. That's what hospitals are good at, acute care. But I think we need community-based health programs. We need to change the way communities think. You know, whether it's a meatless Friday, meatless Wednesday, getting communities back to breastfeeding, having communities that have organic farms, having people walking together. The list is endless of what we can do at a grassroots level for health.
Well, one of the places where I first really got the value of social support medically, you know, was a study that I read. It was done at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. I want to describe it for a moment and see what you think of it. The researchers there studied almost 10,000 married men who had no prior history of angina. And angina, of course, is chest pain that can indicate heart disease. So the researchers found that Those men who had high levels of risk factors, they had elevated cholesterol, they had high blood pressure, they had diabetes, they had electrocardiogram abnormalities. Those men were more than 20 times as likely to develop angina during the next 5 years. But most amazingly, the researchers found that those men who answered yes to the simple question, does your wife show you her love? That's how they worded it. Those men had substantially less angina, even when they had high levels of all those risk factors.
That's exactly right.
So, Mimi, as a cardiologist, what do you make of findings like that?
Well, I think you have to look at the whole picture, right? It's how you live your life, who you live your life with, what is your thought system, what is your attitude, all of these things. If you're in a nurturing, loving environment versus being in an environment that, as some people put it to me, they say, I go home and I'm walking on eggshells. Their relationship is tenuous. They don't feel loved. They feel anxious, actually. And I see this a lot in the cardiovascular side, especially when people become workaholics and they never go home, because home is not a pleasant place to be, that there's all sorts of issues and things like that.
Mimi, I remember Andy Weil, the physician and best-selling author, telling of a man with severe chronic hypertension whose relationship with his wife was filled with stress and tension. The amazing thing was that the day the man's wife filed for divorce, his blood pressure normalized. It just suddenly dropped to a healthy level and stayed there without drugs. Mimi, we have so many cases and we have so many studies showing that the quality of our relationships really influences the quality of our health.
Dean outlines all of this in his book on love and support and intimacy. All of these studies are in there that this is critically important for health. So you need to be in an environment where you are, as I like to put it, at peace. We all have challenges in our lives, but can we find that inner peace within our day-to-day, or are we living in an environment that, for lack of a better word, is toxic? And that environment could be a work environment, it can be a home environment, and so on.
Mimi, when you speak of the importance of finding inner peace, and also the fact that some of us are living in toxic family or work environments, it brings up a question that I think a lot of us are living with. We have a lot of science telling us that our health and our health habits are likely to match those of our closest friends, which implies that it's very important to surround ourselves with people who model healthy habits. Mimi, what can we do if there are people in our families or in our circle of friends who are alcoholics or drug addicts or who just don't take good care of themselves and who eat unhealthy foods consistently?
Okay, let's take it. We all have these people in our family. We all have people that are challenges in our life. We have to make some choices. The first thing we need to do is stabilize our own ship. We need to do something in our daily life which helps us to maintain our inner peace. What can that be? That can be exercising in nature, learning to meditate, which I think is the most powerful tool that anyone can do, centering prayer, if that's something that you prefer, some path toward inner peace. It doesn't matter to me what path you take, but what's important is that you go deep, that you just don't dabble. Oh, I'll do 3 minutes of mindfulness and 2 minutes of transcendental meditation. That doesn't work. So we know that to get to that path of inner peace, a little bit of knowledge, information leads to knowledge, but practice is what leads to pure transformation. So that's the first thing. Then we have to look at our lives and say, does this individual pull me up or does this individual pull me down? How do I feel in the presence of these people? So you have, sometimes we have to make hard decisions. We have to choose who we want in our lives. Do we want people, like for me, I surround myself with a very strong spiritual community. Those are the people I enjoy being around. You have to find where's your tribe and where do you feel good. And quite frankly, sometimes it means limiting communication or disconnecting with people that don't support us. And for those people that have family members that have addictions, unfortunately, you can offer to help when the time is right and when they're ready. But by and large, we cannot change people. We can only change ourselves. And we can't be responsible for other people. We can offer our help, but they have to be willing to help themselves. They have to be willing to take the steps that are necessary. And that, you know, that's a hard lesson. We all want to be in service of people, but sometimes it's not even in their best interest if they're not ready to make a change.
So we sometimes have to limit our exposure to people who are toxic to us in some way. But meanwhile, find new connections, find and improve the connections we have with the people that are part of our tribe. I'm hearing that your tribe is really important to you. I think our tribes, by whatever term we use, our extended communities, our extended families, our networks of support, the people in our lives that care about us, that care about the same things as we do, and that we can care about and feel effective and loving towards, those things are just medically really, really important.
I think at the end of the day, it's everything. Because if you look at some of these communities where people live for a long time, what we call the blue zones, by and large, they're eating correctly, but they have a real sense of community. There's a community spirit. There's a let's go and sit out and everyone in the piazza in the mid-afternoon. There's a sense of connection. There's a purpose in life. You know, when you see certain cultures where the oldest are paired with the youngest, the oldest, the grandparents, they have a purpose in life as opposed to what we tend to do in our culture, which is as people get older, they sort of home alone. Right, all this wisdom is sitting home alone, and that doesn't serve our culture, and that doesn't serve our wisdom keepers, which are our elderly. So I think that there's a fundamental breakdown in our culture in this way. So we need the new tribe, maybe a tribe of your primary family, or it may be a tribe of a newly created family, whether it's your spiritual family, or in the case when we did the Ornish research, it was our cohort family. It to me is the sauce, the secret sauce that is most important in the healing process.
Mimi, I find it rare and precious in life when I find someone who is truly wise in the ways of the human heart. And I think it's particularly rare to find those qualities in a cardiologist, because there's something about medical training and medical practice today that's dehumanizing. But your caring and your compassion for people is so strong. And I find that to be precious. If we're ever going to have a medical system that upholds the health of the human heart in all of its wondrous dimensions, it will be thanks to you and to others like you, Mimi. It's really been a pleasure to have this conversation with you. On behalf of Ocean and myself and of everyone involved in the food revolution, I thank you for your beautiful heart, your wonderful work, and for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I just love, John, being able to talk about what I truly believe is fundamentally important. Thank you.
We've been sharing such a beautiful conversation with Dr. Mimi Guarneri, President of the Academy of Integrative Health and Medicine and author of The Heart Speaks. Mimi, your work combines brilliant intellectual understanding with deep love and understanding of the whole person, and in that you bring us all closer to what I think is real wisdom. We're so grateful for your loving leadership, for sharing your wisdom with all of our listeners, and for your partnership in the food revolution. This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.